And I'm going to introduce Pete Kinsella. I don't know if I've said this previously. I probably have, but I'll take a brief moment to say that Pete has been a tremendous influence on my career, which he may or may not want to accept credit for, only in positive ways. And it's always a pleasure for me to be able to see him and introduce him, because he's incredibly smart and knows a ton about a lot of stuff and will present on stuff that he doesn't even know about. Fortunately, we've got him talking about things that he knows about today. So please welcome Pete Kinsella from Perkins Coie, who's going to talk to us about advanced contracting issues in the cloud.
Thank you, John. So I'm going to talk about two general topics. One is formation issues in the cloud and things you need to think about when trying to enforce contracts on people who click I accept or I agree. And then get into the nitty-gritty of contract terms and the back and forth between provider and customer. So from a formation model, one of the things about cloud is, if done right from a provider perspective, it really is a pure services agreement. And so therefore, the UCC doesn't apply. Now, later in my slide deck, I'm going to talk about UCC land and how that relates to software and compare that to cloud. But in a pure services agreement, UCC does not apply. And so what does that mean? That means that a bunch of case law that has developed under the UCC, unconscionability, failure of essential purpose, is much less defined in the services setting, because we just don't have as many cases there. So I want to talk later about those doctrines and how they apply in a software realm, and give you some thoughts as to how they may or may not apply in the cloud realm. The other thing to be thinking about in a services agreement, the mirror image rule does not apply, right? In the UCC, we have a specific statute that says mirror image rule acceptance and offer does not have to be perfect in order to form a contract. You don't have that sort of legislation in the services realm. So you do need to be thinking about how the contract is formed, when it is formed, and what the contract actually is to help you with dealing with enforceability issues and the like. So first up is the click wrap agreement, right? Click wrap, we've all seen it. Scroll down, read a bunch of text, or more likely don't read a bunch of text, hit I agree, and you have a contract. Those are enforceable throughout the U.S. There's not a whole lot of questions about that. The great thing about Colorado is that we have the Quest decision. And the Quest decision actually enforces a contract that the user didn't actually scroll through and click I accept on. Instead, there was a contract that was presented during a phone call. The agent said, hey, there's these terms and conditions online, there's an early termination fee, and when we sign you up for this service, you're agreeing to be bound by those online terms and conditions. Mr. Vernon objected when he got an early termination fee charged on his bill, went through the court, and the court said, yes, that was an online contract that was formed, and Mr. Vernon has to pay the early termination charges. So we have some wonderful jurisprudence here in Colorado that actually enforces things that people haven't actually seen, although they have been told where they exist and that they can go look at those. From a browse wrap perspective, browse wrap agreements are those agreements at the bottom of the web page that people may or may not look at that purport to govern the terms of use of that website. By and large, the law of the land is that if the users have gone and looked at those and you can prove that, then they will be bound to them. But if you can't show that, you're not going to bind users to those agreements. So much better to bind the user to something where they're clicking I accept and get information from them. The next issue you have with enforceability of entering into contracts is agent authority, right? Does an employee who clicks I accept on that click wrap agreement, can they actually bind their employer? And that gets into agent authority sorts of issues. So basically, an agent can bind their employer if they have either actual authority or if they have apparent authority. Apparent authority gets into a rat's nest of details about whether the other side of the contract actually thought that that person had authority to bind their principal, right? So it's the thought process of the other party to the contract that determines that. Typically, a principal's manifestations will support a binding of apparent authority if they cause the party to actually or subjectively believe that that person had authority to act, or if that person's belief is reasonable. Right, so if you're dealing with a receptionist and you know that the receptionist is a receptionist and they're binding the company to a $10 million contract, you may not have an objectively reasonable belief that that person had authority to sign that. So there's been some litigation that has broken out over the apparent authority issue. And one interesting example is from the Western District of Washington involving spam arrest. In spam arrest, there was a contract that called for liquidated damages to be paid whenever a user used the spam arrest system to send spam through their email system. And so if you did that, you had to pay a $100,000 liquidated damages penalty. Well, Replacements Limited sent spam, according to spam arrest, that triggered something like a $1.2 million liquidated damages claim under the contract. And so spam arrest went in to enforce and collect on their liquidated damages provision. And as part of the spam arrest sign-up procedure, they didn't collect any information about the individuals who were actually clicking I agree. All they were collecting was an IP address from which the I agree was sent. So there was a huge factual issue about which employee actually clicked I agree to this contract, and spam arrest asserted that it was some employees that had the ability to charter jets. And because it was those employees, they also had the ability to sign this contract. But they really didn't know for sure who those individuals were. The court looked at that and just said, you don't have enough factual information here for you to develop an objectively good faith belief that these people had apparent authority or the authority to bind their principal. And so one of the lessons to take away from this case is when you actually hit I accept, make sure you're collecting information. Who is it? The names, the phone numbers, the positions. And the more valuable and large and material that contract is, the more information and details you should confirm so that you can develop a good faith belief that the person can bind their principal. Another case, the NetSuite case out of Utah. In this particular situation, there was an IT person who had been negotiating an agreement. That person was responsible for actually implementing the services, and that person's employer gave them authority to access the online account by using username and password. And in this instance, the court found that those were sufficient factors to support a finding that this person could actually bind their employer. So again, the key is more information, the better it is. If you are dealing with large online contracts, you may want to have some sort of pre-approval process in place, right? Where you know that there's somebody with authority on the other side. They perhaps designate these employees are authorized to contract with you or to amend contracts with you so that you have less of an issue with respect to this. When you're dealing with the simple click-through sorts of an agreement, certainly having language in the contract that where the person represents that they have the authority to bind their employer is at least one factor in your favor. It's not conclusive, but it's better than not having it in there. So with that, I'd like to turn a little bit to the contracting process and what to be thinking about. From a an onboarding process, typically in the more complex cloud arrangements, there may need to be a bunch of work upfront getting data into the cloud or getting data transitioned from another provider before you can actually start the day-to-day work under the contract. Oftentimes in the more complex arrangements, you may have a dedicated transition agreement that's signed as to how that data comes over, when that data comes over, who's doing what, who's verifying the accuracy of the data, et cetera. That agreement may or may not be subject to service level obligations, and we'll talk more about that in a bit. And it also may address how the new provider is going to interface with the existing provider. There can always be some interesting finger pointing who has the obligation to do what in that situation. So in the more complex agreements, it's good to document that. Pricing and payment. Many service providers will seek some sort of advance payments. Oftentimes, that's in the form of an annual advance payment. Sometimes it's monthly in advance. But there's often some sort of advance payment and then an additional monthly or quarterly in arrears payment system to deal with excess usage issues or the like. It's always important to look and figure out how, in fact, is use determined. If fees are based on use, is it the number of users that actually use the system, or is it the number of passwords that have and usernames that have been passed out, et cetera? How do you work price increases? As the provider, you always want to be able to ratchet up the price with or without notice. As a customer, you would hate that. And so it's always important to figure out, are there caps? Is there some sort of advanced notice? And typically, as a customer, you want sufficient advance notice on a price increase to enable you to go somewhere else if you don't like the price increase. And when I say go somewhere else, oftentimes it takes months to go from one provider to another. So you might want 180 days notice or a year's notice before a price increase so you can make that call. And of course, you have the typical benchmarking and most favored nation clauses that you try to negotiate. Those can be very tricky because every customer is different. Every contract may be different. And so again, the normal benchmarking and MFN rules would apply there. The services description. I always like to preach to both my providers and my customer clients that having a very detailed description of the services will reduce hassles later on. It makes it very clear what the provider is providing and what the customer is receiving or not receiving. And so having a very clear description of that will likely result in less dispute later on when the customer says, oh, I thought I was getting X, Y, and Z, and the provider's saying, no, no, that's an extra price. So important to have that detailed description. The issue that you have in cloud is that cloud is always evolving, right? And in a normal software deployment, if the software is working fine, the customer may not want to take an upgrade. It works just great. We're happy with it. We're going to push off that upgrade. In a cloud setting, in a multi-tenant environment, you cannot push off an upgrade. Everybody gets their upgrade at the same time. And so the service is going to evolve. Many companies may deploy, like I think Microsoft deploys updates to their platforms every Tuesday. Many cloud providers are in an agile environment and changes are going on all the time. So what do you do as a customer? As a customer, you want to try to get as much lead time notice as you can and a testing environment, often called a sandbox, so that you can play with the new deployment before it's actually deployed. And you can test whether your APIs and interfaces are going to function with that new environment or whether something's going to break. So you're typically trying to push for advanced testing, a free environment. And then if there's something really material and you are a big customer, you might try to push for some right to push off having that provider deploy that if it's going to break something in your environment. Service levels. This is where the rubber really hits the road in a cloud agreement. And I like to think of service levels as having two components, a service component, which is the metrics, And how you measure the metrics, and a management component, how you actually upgrade and deal with those metrics over time. And so from a service level perspective, first you have to figure out what are the metrics that we're looking at, what are the key metrics, does the service have to be unavailable, or does just parts of it have to be broken, and we'll talk about some definitions in a minute here as examples. How are they reported? Does the customer have to call in and complain, or does the credits get applied automatically? If I'm the provider, I'm going to say, if you didn't call in to complain, you must not have been hurt. You get no credit. As a customer, I might take the opposite approach. And then on a long-term services agreement, think about whether there's some sort of process for adjusting those metrics over time. Right? If the agreement may start, for example, with a 99.5% availability, but the provider over the past 12 months is at 99.8% availability, perhaps there's an averaging mechanism that averages up that availability time over for the next 12 months. It's now 99.65, half of between what it was and what it is. And so you want to be thinking about that from a long-term relationship perspective. From a services component level, you want to identify the services that are being provided that are subject to the SLA, and of course, which services are not. Any sort of assumptions underlying the service, what sorts of equipment the user has to have to interface with your service is an example. The time frames in which you're going to respond to inquiries or problems, the targeted fix times, et cetera, and who does what in the event of a disaster. From a management component perspective, you want to be tracking, how do these metrics get tracked? How often are they reported? Who reports them, et cetera? So I said I'd talk a little bit about some definitions. So two different definitions here. The downtime definition, any period I have greater than 10 minutes. Right, you might see that in a report or in a service level agreement, and if the outage is only 5 minutes, it doesn't count towards the credits. You can also say that during which time the customer is unable to access or use the services because of an error, right? And then you can go into defining what an error is. So there's all sorts of games that can be played in these definitions. I have a provider-friendly definition of an error, means a material failure of the services to conform to the material specs that is caused by a component of the service, right? A double materiality qualifier versus a customer-friendly error, which says any event that causes or is likely to cause disruption to the service or any part of the customer's operations, right? A very expansive definition of how you impact this. So the details get important in these SLAs. When you're dealing with an SLA calculation, there's multiple metrics that can be measured, such as the time between reporting a problem and it actually being acknowledged that the report has been filed. Of course, how long it takes to fix it, data bandwidth and latency issues, how frequently are the reports late, et cetera. And there's different sorts of scorecards that can be used when you're calculating credits. So I think everybody's familiar with perhaps this sort of chart, a pure availability chart. If you have a certain availability measurement and you're underneath that, you get a certain credit applied each month. But there's also a system for measuring something other than availability. And that's when you get into charts like this. What is the thing being measured? What is its priority? Did they achieve this metric or not? And at the end of the month, you count up how many metrics did they miss. And so, for example, if they missed one metric, it's a certain credit. If they missed three metrics, it's a different credit. So there's different ways of actually assigning service credits other than just the traditional availability chart. End user conduct. So here is a place where both the provider and the customer's interests can be aligned. If you have a virus running rampant in your cloud environment, and you as the customer are concerned that your data is going to be corrupted, deleted, encrypted, the parade of horribles, you want that to be fixed. And if that means taking the service down temporarily to fix it, that is better than losing all of your data. And the provider feels the same way as well. oftentimes you will see suspension clauses that are drafted very broadly from a provider perspective that allows them to take the service down for whatever reason and not to have to pinpoint the user accounts, et cetera, that are the cause of that problem. From a customer perspective, if you have 20,000 users on the cloud and you happen to have two accounts that have a virus in them, you would prefer not to have all 20,000 accounts disabled. You would prefer to have the two accounts disabled. So from a customer perspective, you try to target these clauses, narrow them down to events that are going to cause material damage to a party, and that the provider has to try to limit the scope of their suspension and then either immediately notify you before or after they do it, so you can both work together to deal with that. The other thing to deal with end user restrictions is to note that they are different than software restrictions, right? I think we're all used to seeing thou shall not reverse engineer, make derivative works, et cetera. In a cloud setting, those restrictions, some of them are the same, some of them are not. So you start looking at things like using the service in violation of law, right? They're transmitting unlawful data. That's a no-no. Sending or storing infringing, obscene, threatening materials. You also get into interference with other users, right? In a normal software license, you can use your piece of software. It doesn't matter what you're doing on it. You're not going to affect others. In a cloud environment, what you do in one account may actually disrupt other users' accounts. And so you'll see some of that in the restrictions as well. And of course, the issue is, well, if I'm the customer, how do I know that I'm overburdening the system, right? We need some metrics in here or something, because I'm going to use the system how I want to use it, and I'm assuming you, the provider, have enough technical back end to handle my demands. Ownership of custom developments in cloud, very rare that the vendor is going to give you ownership of anything they do. Again, it's one monolithic piece of software. They want to own everything. If you have some sort of single tenant or traditional software agreement, maybe you can get some sort of ownership of custom developments. I'm going to talk a little bit about privacy and some of the issues that have arisen in Europe. So first for the map, I know I've shown this before, it's not a political map, but basically under the EU privacy laws, if you have any sort of personally identifiable information, you are allowed to export that to a blue country or to a green country without a whole bunch of additional headaches. You are not able to export data to a red country. And you'll notice that the United States and much of the world is a red country. And so under EU law, when you have personally identifiable information such as names, email addresses, phone numbers, you cannot take those to a red country unless you jump through some additional hoops. And so in the past, up until October of last year, we had a couple of different ways to deal with that. And you still have, you can always ask for consent under EU law, but that request for consent has to be very detailed, prominent, et cetera. You also have the EU model contract clauses, where you have a contract clause between the exporting party and the importing party. The importing party agrees to treat that data as if it was governed under EU law, and there's contractual recourse in the event that they don't. And then you had the US safe harbor, where basically the US company would register with the Department of Commerce, and they, if things went bad, the Department of Commerce would step in and investigate and do all sorts of things if somebody mishandled that EU data. The problem was Edward Snowden. He came out and exposed that the US government may or may not care so much about protecting individual privacy. And so the EU regulators started to go nuts when the Snowden revelations came about, and they're going, safe harbor, US government doesn't care about privacy, they don't care about private data, and so therefore on October 6th, we had a ruling that said basically that the EU safe harbor system was unconstitutional under EU law, and totally threw out a very easy way of registering and protecting data. And so now we are left with consent, the model contract clauses, and what are called binding corporate rules, where you amend your corporate charter in order to comply with EU data protection. The binding corporate rules have rarely been used in the past 10 years, although they're starting to get more play. Many sophisticated companies saw the Edward Snowden issue coming for about the last 2 years. And many, I guess most of the contracts I've negotiated with European entities have had a model contract clause component to that. Now, as part of the EU model contract clauses, there is typically addendums that get attached to those model clauses that detail the security precautions that the receiving party is going to take to protect that data. And so for a while, there have been complex data agreements, model clauses, and a DPA underneath them saying, hey, this is how we're going to protect the data. Because this has been going on for about 2 years, a bunch of people are going, well, hey, this works for personally identifiable data. Let's expand this to all data. And so the trend has been, hey, let's have a DPA. It may or may not be attached to EU model clauses. It may just be attached to a contract between two US entities, but we are going to have a very detailed appendix identifying how the receiving party is going to protect the data. And this has been a wonderful piece of negotiation that requires you to figure out things like encryption standards, password lengths, and other things, and they keep getting longer and longer every day that I see one. Some of the common elements in a DPA, certainly some sort of policy requirement that the receiving party have a policy. It may also require them to have a security officer, et cetera. Possibly some sort of training and screening component, background checks on their employees, that they go through privacy training, et cetera. Definitely a huge part of technical security measures, encryption, separation of data, et cetera. Record keeping log requirements that you track who's entering into the system, where they're coming from, IP addresses, usernames, et cetera. Testing and audit measures, which can be tricky in a cloud environment if you have other customers' data on your server. You can't exactly let one customer come in and look at data and expose them to other customer data. That can be a little bit complex. Procedures for fixing it, and obligations in the event that there is a security breach. When you're thinking about these security issues, I like to have two different buckets: a security event and a security issue bucket and a security incident bucket. The issues bucket is basically there's a vulnerability that may or may not have been detected, but it hasn't been exploited yet. What do you do about it, versus a security incident where you've actually had a breach. So the first thing to deal with is how do you define security issues. There are websites out there that have objective measurements on how you classify a particular security level, and you can give it a certain number and things like that, and then the provider is supposed to maybe perhaps fix the highest valued numbers. And so you need to be thinking about how do you deal with that. From a customer perspective, ideally if there's some sort of issue that is known, and if the provider doesn't fix it and that vulnerability is exploited, you as the customer would love to have increased liability caps in that instance. So it's something to think about. From an incident perspective, you need to get into the notification requirements, but the bigger battle is around remediation. Who does what and who pays for it? If you need to get credit reporting services for 1 million customers, that's a lot of money. And the question is do you as the customer pay for that, or does the vendor pay for that? And that also gets to be a very nice conversation to have. Data retention issues. Oftentimes, customers want you to keep the data as a provider until they no longer need it. And as a provider, you have no idea. When does the customer need it? When do they not need it? Ideally, I think the best practices is to have a very detailed procedure that says when the data gets deleted, particularly upon termination. right, that there might be a 30-day window following termination. And after 30 days, that data is gone unless the customer provides a written notice that they need it extended for X more days. But it's always best for all data to be gone when it's no longer needed. That's in everybody's best interest. Compliance requirements. We have some laws, particularly HIPAA, here in the US, that requires particular contractual obligations, encryption obligations be imposed to protect that data. From a customer perspective, customers love to tell providers, hey, we want you, the provider, to comply with all applicable laws. And the question is, laws applicable to whom, right? If I am a provider and I'm not HIPAA compliant, I don't want to have to comply with your HIPAA obligations. There are certainly some vendors out there that are HIPAA compliant, VRPA compliant, et cetera, but you need to be very careful of this. And as a customer, you need to understand what the provider actually does and look at that. There's often many providers out there at the second tier level that are willing to try to be compliant with some of your obligations, but you really need to have that spelled out. Confidentiality clauses. They may serve as a backdoor security clause. If you have a confidentiality clause that says neither party will allow unauthorized individuals to access the other party's confidential information, well, that clause is breached if a hacker gets into the system and looks at the data. So many times providers will write those clauses as, we're going to use commercially reasonable efforts to protect your data. Right, without getting into whether it's going to be disclosed or not. It's just a protection obligation rather than a definitive we won't disclose or allow others to access the data obligation. Subcontractors, another huge issue, both from an EU perspective and from a HIPAA perspective. Under EU law, given safe harbor is out the window, if you have subcontractors that have access to personally identifiable information, those subcontractors also have to be subject to binding, either binding corporate rules or binding model clauses. And you need to understand which subcontractors have access to your data. So there's a huge flow down negotiation that now takes place where what is the obligation of the provider to flow down obligations onto their subcontractors. Now, most big Fortune 500s have their model cloud services agreement, which actually require approval of each subcontractor before they can access the data. And most providers say, I don't want you interfering with any of my operations. There's no way I'm giving you approval. What I can do is post a list of my current subcontractors, and as new ones come on, I'll update the list. And if there's somebody on there that you think is, I don't know, dishonest, you can go ahead and pull the plug and take your data elsewhere. So there's an interesting negotiation there. For HIPAA, HIPAA requires a flow down of BAAs, business associate agreements, onto everybody who has access to health protected information. So again, if you have, and oftentimes in the cloud, you may have a small provider that you are doing business with, but that small provider has Google or Amazon or Microsoft in the background that's actually storing the data. You need to understand where those data centers are and what the contractual relationship is between the provider and the place where the data is actually being stored and processed. And that can be a wonderfully complex sort of discussion and very interesting. Disaster recovery. Certainly from a customer perspective, you want to know that the provider is able to provide disaster recovery services. Step one is asking whether the provider has a plan. If they are a startup, they may not even have a disaster recovery plan. That will tell you something about where they are. Many providers will, again, rely on Amazon, Microsoft, Google in the background to provide their DR services, and that's a good thing for you to understand. But even if you have the big three in the background, it may be important for you to understand whether the disaster recovery plan is actually tested, right? Is the provider, can they actually retrieve data? Are they doing something to the data that might not allow the normal recovery procedures to work in the background. So testing it is a very good thing. Force majeure, you need to be aware of the interplay between force majeure and disaster recovery, because most force majeure events would override the disaster recovery obligations, right? You have a snowstorm, it wipes out a data center, that's an act of God. The force majeure clause says we don't have any obligations then. So those two things need to work hand in hand. Escrows. So in a cloud setting, we are finally starting to see some escrow providers that can operate in a cloud environment. And basically how it works is, particularly if you have a provider that's using Google, Microsoft, Amazon in the background, those providers have what's called a virtual machine environment. It's basically a bunch of software that operates like a computer running somewhere, except it's all virtual. And you can identify that virtual environment by the list of software. It may run on Linux, it may run on Windows, there's all these different components. And there are providers that are now willing to host that virtual environment on their own environment in the event that the provider goes bankrupt or can't perform, et cetera. So we are finally starting to see, so for years I've said, escrow doesn't matter for cloud, it won't happen. We finally have providers that are able to start to deal with escrow in a cloud setting. It's still incredibly complex dealing with how do you get the data over to that escrow provider, how frequently does it get backed up, et cetera. But it's something that is now a thing, as my kids like to say. So risk mitigation, you know, certainly from a customer perspective, operating procedures, auditing those procedures, putting in place the warranties, indemnities, and then perhaps a wraparound insurance policy. And that can take many, many different forms. So the operating procedures, if you're the customer, you want those documented. Are they doing what they said they're going to do? Are they following their data protection agreement? Are they doing the background screening, et cetera? From a warranty perspective, the vendors will often provide what I like to call soft warranties, right? So compare these two examples. A vendor will have a security policy versus vendor will have and comply with its security policy, right? I have seen wonderful data protection addendums that have things like that first sentence in them that are like 8-10 pages long, and you're going, where's the mean? Right? So, and another example, you know, vendor will prevent unauthorized access versus vendor will have reasonable security measures in place that are designed to prevent unauthorized access. Again, very weak versus something very strong. The devil is in the details here. You really got to read it and understand it. And there's all sorts of warranties that you can ask for as a customer. From an indemnity perspective, vendors will typically give some sort of indemnity around IP infringement. They are much more loath to provide indemnities around data loss, et cetera, because it puts them in a position of acting as an insurance company. Right, and so part of the discussions between warranties and indemnity and insurance is who actually should ultimately pay for the risk of loss. And many cloud vendors will say, look, I'll go out and get you a special insurance policy for $20 million, but I'm going to add that to your price. Do you really want that, or do you want to go get your own insurance policy and we'll have, you know, some sort of lower cap here? On the IP front, think of two different indemnity scenarios that are coming out. And I like to think of it as the traditional indemnity versus the defend and pay indemnity. And here's an example of the traditional one, right? Vendor will indemnify, defend, and hold customer harmless against the parade of horribles, right? And then typically this indemnity is excluded from the liability cap. Right, so in the event that something bad really happens, I as the customer get defense, I get damages arising from this, and perhaps they're uncapped if the provider didn't know what was going on. So the new trend from a provider perspective is a defend and pay position. I, as the vendor, I'm going to defend you in the event there's an IP issue. And I'm going to pay for any finally awarded damages that may arise from this or a settlement that arises. But I'm not going to let you get consequential damages. I'm not going to let you go to some other vendor and charge me the difference. I'm not going to let you come after me for the, you know, costs related to migrating to another system. I'm going to defend you, and I'm going to pay the amounts of damages. So just be aware that there is a shift going on. And again, this is something probably in the last 3 years that has slowly been building up in agreements. You always have issues around the exclusions in indemnity. And so one example in the IP land is combinations, right? Where the vendor says, hey, I'll indemnify you, but I'm not going to indemnify you for a combination claim. Well, think about a cloud setting, right? A cloud setting is I have a phone or there's a laptop that's accessing data in the internet, and after, and so typically the customer has to bring their own hardware equipment to interface with the cloud service, and that right there is the creation of the combination, right? And so the provider may step away from their indemnity obligation because you, the customer, are using a piece of hardware that the vendor frankly knew you were going to use anyway. So you get into all sorts of issues about, well, how is that? I mean, you should maybe be indemnifying me for some combinations if that combination is needed for me to access your service. So there's all sorts of wonderful discussions there. So I want to spend the last 7 minutes here talking about limits on liability, unconscionability, et cetera. And first, I'm going to go look at the UCC for a minute and go back to software land, right? So in software land, under the UCC, an agreement may provide for remedies different or in substitution of the UCC remedies under certain circumstances. So as long as the parties agreed that these would be the exclusive remedies, and as long as they weren't limiting them in an unconscionable manner, which we'll talk about in a bit, the parties could agree to limit their remedies. And so you have some sort of caps where you're limiting the heck out of everything, both as to the amount and type of damages. The UCC also says that where circumstances cause an exclusive or limited remedy to fail of its essential purpose, then any sort of remedy may be had under the UCC, right? The limitation goes away, and you're now living potentially in uncapped liability land. In addition, consequential damages may be limited or excluded unless the limitation or exclusion is unconscionable. And so, and we're going to talk about unconscionability here in a minute, and then again, there's some exceptions to that. So that's where the UCC sets up. And so when you start looking at failure of essential purposes, right, where I give you a remedy, what happens both to if the remedy fails for direct damages and what happens to consequential damages when it fails? And so typically most jurisdictions apply a two-part test. First, you try to identify what the essential purpose of the limited remedy is, and then you identify whether or not it in fact failed to meet its purpose. And so we have like a Colorado case on point where there was a grain dryer for feed for cattle. It was installed on a farmer's property. It didn't work. The repairs, they kept trying to repair it, I think something like 50 times, couldn't get it to fix. Cattle were losing weight, dying. And finally, it was like, enough is enough. I'm going to sue you for damages. And the court looked at that and said, yeah, the repair remedy was not sufficient because you could never repair it. You could never fix it. There's another Colorado case dealing with piping in an oil well where they had a repair or replace remedy, but the people put the pipe in the ground to drill for oil, and it ended up that the piping didn't meet the specs, and since the pipes are thousands of feet underground, the repair or replace remedy doesn't quite work. And in Colorado, when that happens, typically, if you have language, the bolded language at the bottom, that the limitations will apply notwithstanding a failure of their purpose or for any limited remedy, or other language, it is possible in Colorado to preserve the consequential damages limitation even if the remedy has failed of its essential purpose. And Colorado is one of a few jurisdictions that appear to allow that split. In most jurisdictions, if your remedy fails of its essential purpose, you are exposed to consequential damages as well. Here in Colorado, we at least have a chance of trying to protect ourselves from those in that instance. Unconscionability, there are all sorts of jurisdictions that have different rules as to how to apply them. In Colorado, we apply a multi-factored test about whether an agreement is unconscionable. Most jurisdictions will have a two-part. It will be a substantive unconscionability analysis and a procedural analysis. Here in Colorado, we mix that together. And then you try to balance all of those factors. And a Colorado case that I love is the general insurance case, which is basically a rental car agreement for leasing a rental car. A contract was held to not be unconscionable, even though there was unequal bargaining power, even though there was fine print in the agreement, even though the fine print was difficult to read. It was still not unconscionable because the court found that most people thought that the contract would be unfair to them anyway. They expected it to be unfair, and so therefore, because they expected it to be unfair, it wasn't unconscionable. So think about, you know, that as you go around looking at this. What I will tell you is there are some jurisdictions that require bargained for limitations of liability in order to have some of these limitations apply. And the question is, well, how do you bargain for something in a cloud agreement, right? We're trying to do mass negotiations in the cloud. I can't do 100,000 contracts in a month. And so one way of thinking about it is perhaps make the limitations of liability mutual with exceptions. Right? So neither each party disclaims their warranties. Each party disclaims the ability to collect consequential damages from the other. Each party has a cap, except in certain circumstances. And what might those circumstances be? Failure to pay money? Maybe an indemnity situation? Right? So you can set up some sort of mutuality in these limitation clauses, and they might actually start to become less prone to attack because you've done that. And of course, you can throw some language in your cloud contract that says these are bargained for, they're negotiated, or if you do really want to bargain for them and negotiate it, contact so-and-so, and so-and-so will say, no, I don't want to do that, right? You've bargained. So with that, the last thing I want to talk about is insurance issues. And basically just say a bunch of these risk liability issues are really who bears the loss. Insurance can be had fairly cheaply in cyber security land. It is amazing how many millions of dollars of coverage you can get for tens of thousands of premium, or not even tens of thousands of premium. And so oftentimes, you know, when we're sitting here battling over 2 million or 5 million or 10 million on liability caps, it may be far better and more protective of the client to just go out and get an insurance policy and deal with it that way. So with that, I am out of time, and I appreciate you paying attention. Thank you.